Hi, everyone, and welcome to Radio Cloud Native from Marantis, where we break down the week's news on Kubernetes, the cloud native landscape, and the wider world of tech. I'm Eric Gregory.
And I'm John Janshig.
Nick's getting some much-deserved R&R, but in the meantime, John and I are back from KubeCon. We've got more reports and observations from the show, including the new integration between Cilium and the Grafana stack, and some fascinating new WASM platforms, as well as a look at cloud trends here in the last stretch of the year. Before we jump in, though, I want to shout out our own senior engineer, Yuzi Newman, who caught and fixed a nasty IP tables bug in Kubernetes 1.25. As Yuzi put it, quote, "Essentially, the problem boils down to an incompatibility issue between IP tables 1.8.8 and older versions in terms of how rules are formatted. As a result, if the host is using IP tables 1.8.8, when components like KubeRouter CNI start to write their own network policy and rules with an older version of IP tables, KubeRouter ships with IP tables 1.8.7, things go explosion emoji," unquote. Yuzi wrote up an excellent post on the Marantis blog to explain his fix. We'll share that in the live chat. But if you're listening or watching later, the title is "Networking Problems After Installing Kubernetes or Upgrading Your Host OS. It Might Be Your IP Tables Version." So kudos to Yuzi. And if you're running into networking problems with 1.25, this might be the fix. All right, let's talk KubeCon. There was a lot we couldn't get to last week, either because of time constraints or embargoes, or just because we hadn't experienced those things yet as we passed through space-time. So, John, you noted last week that observability in general and observability platforms in particular were a big theme for the show, and you talked about OpenTelemetry and Lightstep. And we saw some more interesting things going on in this space over at Grafana Labs and Isovalent. Grafana Labs announced a new integration between their dashboards and the Cilium network overlay. The really interesting thing about Cilium is the way it builds on eBPF, or Extended Berkeley Packet Filter, the Linux kernel functionality that was really only fully unlocked recently by the cgroups v2 hitting general availability. eBPF lets code run in a sandbox at the kernel level, and that opens up a lot of interesting possibilities, just one of which is facilitating sophisticated observability without the need for sidecar containers. Now, a partnership between Isovalent, the creators of Cilium, and Grafana Labs is aiming to leverage eBPF for more sophisticated connectivity observability through Grafana Labs tools like Loki, Grafana, Tempo, and Mimir. This aims to help solve the problem of getting fine-grained data on connectivity issues in what might be a complex, sprawling applications environment with who knows how many replicas of who knows how many microservices running across who knows how many nodes. In the constant IP churn of Kubernetes, it's challenging to follow a problem to a specific culprit. Traditionally, one of the better ways to accomplish this has been through a service mesh that adds a sidecar to your containers, but that obviously imposes a performance tax, especially at scale. The idea here is to use eBPF and Cilium, which gives you a whole new connectivity fabric as an alternative to IP tables to create stable service identities that come with a much lighter performance cost. The way the Grafana blog explains it, quote, "Cilium generates in-kernel eBPF programs based on the identity of the workload. These eBPF programs export observability data to the Grafana Labs LGTM stack," unquote. If you're interested in playing around with this yourself, there's a hands-on demo available at GitHub under the Isovalent account and the project Cilium-Grafana-observability-demo. Easy to follow there. Cilium had a big show beyond the Grafana stack integration. They applied for CNCF graduated status live on stage, and Microsoft's AKS announced that they were using Cilium for their CNI, Container Network Interface, data plane, giving Cilium the hat trick with all three of the big public cloud providers using them for CNI.
Fabulous.
Yeah, really exciting stuff. I think we're gonna see a lot of eBPF-driven projects, I think, really, you know, first happening suddenly and then all at once kind of exploding over this next year. I'm expecting to see a lot emerging quite soon.
It seems like a lot is impacting observability now. It feels like a good time for observability around Kubernetes. One of the things, in fact, unrelated directly to technology, but indirectly very important, that I did at KubeCon is I stopped by honeycomb.io. Because I saw the multicolored hair of iconic CEO Charity Majors, who was there signing books. Honeycomb.io has recently published by O'Reilly a book called Observability Engineering, Achieving Production Excellence, which Majors wrote, along with Liz Fong-Jones, late of Google, and George Miranda. And she actually gave me a copy and was kind enough to sign it. And I got to share with her a story of her saving my professional life many years ago when she was the guru of heavy database tiers under Linden Labs' Second Life. I won't go into that story here, but Majors has major database engineering chops behind her observability innovation and is a very impressive technologist, particularly when she saves your bacon at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Cool.
Moving on, we talked to Slim AI at KubeCon. Slim AI is a company that that makes a range of products. Their best known is a system for compressing for generating software bills of materials from containers, and specifying reductions that that remove unused dependencies and do other things to slim them down and make them smaller and reduce their attack surface, which is sort of the purpose of this story. Last week they published something called their public container report, which was a free intelligence report, which detailed their scanning more than 160 at that point. I think the number is closer to 200 now. Container images, public container images, making up 30% of total global pull volume. So these are the most popular public containers in the world, using a combination of open source and proprietary scanning tools. And they plan to quickly expand this data set to cover some larger subset of the public containers used by devs today across the many, the many registry providers. Their website for this project observes very strict kind of open source norms of anonymity for people who want to check out and use this data. They're not asking for people to create accounts or do other things unless they want to really, really drill deep. But you can see the useful superficial data without any commitments. What they've done is categorize containers by various criteria, including vulnerability counts by severity and container construction details, that SBOM that we were talking about, package information, along with comparisons between public containers and similar public containers. So you actually have some criteria for choosing between, what's in column A and what's in column B.
Very cool.
And we talked with Peter von Nortenen, their senior director of growth, at KubeCon, who explained the process. He said the scans were being produced and updated daily by an automated system that applies Slim AI's own software to generate an SBOM, and then additional vulnerability assessment products to expose issues. They also provide an after list of remaining vulnerabilities after Slim AI's container minimizing software has stripped out unused dependencies. So, you're certainly in not so great shape if your initial scan reveals 976 criticals, but if you have 12 after slimming, that's better. So what comes out of this workflow potentially is useful as a first step of for people who are interested in curating public images for potential use by their organizations, and also of course for making base images as slim as possible, which, as we said, reduces potential attack surface and eliminates the threat of not yet discovered vulnerabilities as well. But it's not redundant with other safeguards. Developers will typically add more stuff, including stuff they may or may not write themselves. We know developers, So vulnerability scanning as a function of normal iterative container development workflows is still an absolute requirement. This is typically implemented on the container registry or elsewhere in the workflow. In Miranda's case, our secure registry product uses Synoptic scanning with its vulnerability database updated daily and delivered by Mirantis.
Very nice. So we talked a little bit last week about Docker's new WASM integration, but there was more interesting WebAssembly news and talk out of the show. And there were two specifically WASM-focused companies present, Cosmonic and Fermion. At KubeCon, Cosmonic announced their WebAssembly platform as a service, which has a free developer tier and is an open developer preview. built on the open source CNCF project Wasm Cloud. The Cosmonic platform is billed as a, quote, lightweight, low boilerplate environment that dramatically simplifies application development and allows developers to run their apps anywhere at scale in minutes, unquote. Fermion also announced a cloud for WebAssembly development. This one has a target for its Spin WebAssembly microservice framework and CLI tool. Previously, you would use Spin to deploy to the open source self-hosted Fermion platform in a kind of serverless model. And now if you don't want to do any platform setup, you can simply deploy to Fermion's cloud. Both companies had folks present at a Docker-hosted Wasm is awesome, Wasm is awesome evening session, which provided some eye-opening insights into Wasm's kind of low-key nose-to-the-grindstone adoption at places like Disney Plus and Zoom, as well as in some interesting edge contexts like TV firmware. It also gave me some validation for my pronunciation of Wasm because I heard every single possible pronunciation in the course of that panel. Speaking of sessions, I mentioned serverless models a moment ago, and serverless was a really hot topic at the show. There was a Knative panel that had standing room only, and that panel was quite interesting. It made the case for Knative as an easier way to develop on Kubernetes. And that's a simple point that I think is kind of deceptively non-obvious. You know, I think when we're thinking about the full stack of Kubernetes tools, we tend to think of something like Knative as an additional conceptual layer on top of Kubernetes core. And it is. But really, the intention is to have a much easier development model, right? Something with a lot less overhead than, you know, creating a bunch of disparate Kubernetes resources when you're working on something that fundamentally is a microservice. So super interesting panel, and alongside security and eBPF and observability, serverless was, to me, one of the big themes to come out of the show.
You know, and it wasn't a theme in a sense that was restricted to serverless. We met with folks from a startup called Elotl, which does a serverless-like thing with public cloud hyperscaler nodes in Kubernetes contexts. Mm-hmm. They will they basically let you create clusters on any infrastructure, including public clouds, and suppress the creation of infrastructure and the building of worker nodes until those worker nodes are actually required for workloads. And they have heuristics that let them minimize, for example, the number of workloads active, you know, in a cluster without imposing the delay in the same way that, you know, sophisticated serverless systems overcome problems associated with slow starts and so on, you know, in early sort of versions of serverless, you know, paradigm. This is really kind of interesting because it implies that you can, you know, stack these products to create functioning serverless platforms that literally use no rented infrastructure at all until functions are deployed and begin accepting traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty incredible.
In the meantime, there was a lot of there was also, of course, a certain amount of talk about technologies that we love to give side eye to, like blockchain. JFrog, in fact, introduced an initiative called Peercia. I guess that's the correct pronunciation, which is now an officially incubated product under the Continuous Delivery Foundation. Peercia is a software supply chain play that uses blockchain to ensure binary and transaction integrity around packages and distributed, presumably including public registries and repos. What we still would like to understand better is how blockchain adds unique value here. We can see the technology being used to prevent, for example, third-party injection of malicious code into an open source repo or provisioning of binaries containing malware using some person in the middle evil strategy. But what we can't follow so well, and this may just be because I'm dumb, is how this differs from using other commonplace old school methods of tamper proofing binary artifacts like CRCs and stuff like that. It seems like blockchain potentially adds overhead here, as well as potential questions about it, you know, endorsement, responsibility, provenance, that don't need to be added to complicate the question of trustworthy security. In any case, the idea of being able to reliably trust and use components stored conveniently across, you know, the many options available on the internet to open source projects and software distributors is very praiseworthy. Ultimately, the concern is always going to remain that nothing but human curation, assisted potentially with container security analytics and AI source code checking and other technologies, can really robustly guarantee that the code you glom won't bite you.
The code always gloms back, or always can. That hits a bunch of the big themes we identified for KubeCon this year. And I think for the remainder of our stories, we're kind of getting out past KubeCon and into the wild frontier of the months to come. So any last thoughts on KubeCon and, themes and folks therein?
As usual... but it was nice to experience it firsthand again. KubeCon takes the comfort of attendees and presenters very seriously and does an absolutely first-rate job of making a grueling, long conference, bearable to mere mortals. it creates an environment where everyone is welcome. It has very clear codes of conduct and enforces them around everything from behavior to masking in this case. It had strict standards for presenting, proof of tests and vaccinations and other things, to get in and police those things reliably day to day, in a way that did not add any significant friction. So nobody had to wait online. It was a piece of cake if your papers were in order. And they took care of people beautifully, right down to the level of the snacks served on the show floor. Just everything was delicious. Vegetarians were accommodated. I mean, it was nice. It was really, really nice. And when you're 16 hours a day, you really appreciate the niceness and the thoughtfulness of building a show that way.
Yeah, kudos to the myriad people involved to make something like that happen.
A cast of thousands.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to kind of the broader industry writ large. So, amid all the kind of global economic turmoil of our present moment, the big three public cloud providers have all reported slowing growth rates for their cloud businesses. And buried in this overall trend are some interesting shifts in dynamics. For example, Google Cloud has managed to take some market share from Azure and AWS, growing at a faster rate than those competitors in the third quarter. In conversation with The Register, Gartner Vice President and analyst Sid Nagg says, quote, "Current inflationary pressure and macroeconomic conditions are having a push and pull effect on cloud spending. Cloud computing will continue to be the bastion of safety and innovation, supporting growth during uncertain times due to its agile, elastic, and scalable nature," unquote. And that's why he judges that, another quote, "cloud migration is not stopping." But not everyone is moving to the public cloud. As we discussed last week, some of the folks who have been there longest are coming back home. John, you talked about DHH's "Why We're Leaving the Cloud" post last episode, and you've kind of got some more on that score this week, right?
Well, in the course of researching some white papers and other writtens, I ran across an article from InfoWorld that reiterated the points made by DHH in "Why We're Leaving the Cloud." A decade or more into the cloud revolution, initial hopes for public cloud that promised paradise of platforms on demand and simplified operations and pay-by-use cost efficiencies have substantially failed to materialize for not a minority of users. Mm-hmm. A KPMG 2022 executive report on technology reiterated this point. Something like 60% of public cloud users have failed to achieve what they call substantial ROI, which means that You know, and many have failed to reach anything that they would define as ROI, which is, you know, interesting. Yeah. Certainly, we don't expect that people are going to walk away from elasticity. But to reiterate David Heinemeier-Hansen's points, there are still those use cases, you know, that cloud is, you know, public cloud is great for simple, you know, singular low traffic apps with no customers yet, where you absolutely do save on complexity and cost of entry, and popular apps with crazy bursty traffic where you never know how many servers you're going to need. But customers are looking at alternatives. It is going to be an extremely interesting time, we think, for private cloud and for people who can help customers overcome the still significant complexity frictions and challenges associated with putting apps on data centers again.
Yeah, absolutely. The big public clouds have made it so easy to jump on board that it's only just now, I think, coming to pass that folks sort of take a look around and go, okay, I made this very easy move. Has it benefited me in any way? and just reiterating what you just said and what David Heinemeier-Hansen said, there are use cases, of course. There are many, many use cases where the specific offering of the public cloud is going to be exactly what an organization needs. But what we're finding is that one tool isn't going to solve every problem. It isn't the universal panacea that it kind of got hyped as. And it's going to be really interesting to watch how that recognition plays out and kind of trickles down as more and more folks spend more and more time in that paradigm.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, over in Linux world, Linus Torvalds recently announced that version 6.1 of the Linux kernel has its first release candidate with a final release targeting early or mid-December. And this one is interesting because the big news here is the scrappy early implementation of Rust in the kernel is here. After being pushed from version 6.0, it's taking its sort of baby's first step in 6.1. It really is kind of like a baby's first step. It's incredibly exciting. It's probably not going to be walking, immediately. This is not anywhere close to production ready, but it's available for poking and prodding. And this release candidate of 6.1 is available at kernel.org right now. And Rust has its own milestone coming up. A few days ago, Jack Huey, writing on behalf of the Rust Types team, posted a blog announcing that generic associated types will be stable in Rust 1.65, which is expected to hit full release on November 3rd, tomorrow, here at the time of recording. According to Huey, quote, "As of Rust 1.65, generic associated types, or GATs, will be stable over 6.5 years after the original RFC was opened. This is truly a monumental achievement. However, as with a few of the other monumental features of Rust, like async or const generics, there are limitations in the initial stabilization that we plan to remove in the future," unquote. In short, this update will allow for more comprehensive usage of generics in Rust. As the blog post says, quote, "In general, GATs provide a foundational basis for a vast range of patterns and APIs. If you really want to get a feel for how many projects have been blocked on GATs being stable, go scroll through the tracking issue," unquote. And if you want to get a more detailed understanding of the possibilities and limitations here, check out the Rust team's blog post at blog.rustlang.org, hyphen between Rust and Lang. It's really in-depth, really comprehensive, and we'll make for some fascinating reading for excited Rustations.
How much Rust have you written, Eric?
Well, very, very, very little. Hello worlds.
Me too. I did the Hello World thing a number of years ago, but around the same time as I started Python. But for some reason, Python and I took off together and danced happily through the unicorn-like flower fields of cloud, and I left my Rust behind. Now I have to go back, don't I?
Yeah, that's how I'm feeling.
Well, Advent of Code is coming up, so we could do Advent of Code in 100% Rust this year.
Oh, more to come. To be continued. All right. Any last thoughts on our topics and items for this week?
Well, it's great to be back I never thought I'd say this. It's great to be back in the office after a week. but KubeCon was inspiring. And, you know, as they say, no matter where it lives, cloud isn't going away. You know, we seem to be in the right place and working with the right tools, automation, automation, automation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that does us for today. Thanks as always to producer Nika and to Luis and DJ on social and video respectively. We're available in podcast format on all the major formats, platforms, whatever, everywhere. And you can also join us live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern through the Mirantis LinkedIn page. Thanks to all of y'all for listening, and we'll see you next time.